co-phased or not co-phased in phase with each other, and therefore you get a signal buildup. So funny things happen with real transmitters with a short circuit on the end of the cable. And sometimes predicting what's going to happen is a little bit difficult because you've got a thoroughly reflecting device on both ends of the cable, and yet you're pumping energy into the cable. Depending on the length of the cable, some really wild things can happen. Over to you, Wes, N2XJN, K2LAW.
Now, when the frequency of the transmitter is lower than the resonant frequency of that sort of antenna, whatever it is, then we're going to have capacitive character of the circuit, and then when it's higher, we have the inductive one. Is that true?
I think the answer to that is yes. I may have to switch frequencies. Stand by. There is a, what's the word I'm looking for now? There is a coupling. If I've got a resonant network connected to the end of a coax cable, and I'm feeding a signal lower than resonance, I will see, depends on how you couple to it, lower than resonant, I think I'm going to see an inductive reactance. Yes. Your parallel LC network is a pure resistor at resonance, very high resistor. As I go lower in frequency than resonant, it becomes inductive. As I go higher in frequency than resonant, it becomes a capacitor. N2XJN, K2LAW. I can still hear you, so go ahead with your question. It depends on how you couple. If I'm coupling my signal generator in series with the inductor, let me think about that, and I go if I go to a higher frequency than resonance, I still see an inductance. Yep, I still see an inductance. So it looks like most of the usual ways of connecting a coax cable to a LC network, I will see inductive reactance when I'm lower than resonance. I'll see capacitive reactance when I'm higher than resonance. There may be a way I could connect it so I get the opposite effect, but the usual way people couple it, that's what happens. And there's ways you can figure that one out. If I've got an inductor and a capacitor at the end of a coax cable, the amount of capacitor reactants and inductor reactants are equal to each other. When I go lower in frequency than resonance, the inductive reactant is a smaller number than the capacitor reactants. And because it's in shunt at the end of the cable, the lower impedance dominates. Therefore, you will see inductance when you're feeding it at a frequency below resonance. N2XJN, K2LAW. Okay, sounds like you're going to send us a schematic. But I'm reasonably sure of what I said. Whenever you put an inductor and a capacitor both across the end of a cable, when you're lower than resonance, the inductive reactance is lower than the capacitor reactance, and lower reactance dominates. As you go to a low enough frequency, it becomes a dead short circuit, and you won't even know the capacitor is there. So you can see how you will see an inductance when you feed it a frequency that's below resonance. N2XJN, K2RW. All right, for those who are listening tonight, this was TechNet number 1509 of the series that began in September 1982. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. And we'll almost get this reciprocity of antennas and signals that propagate. We'll almost get that settled next week. You wait and see. K2RW clear. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other.
Good night, Dick. This is 2WGB. Thank everyone for joining us. We'll be back here next week. That would be nice. We're going to try to be here. All right, KC2WGB clear.
Did you put those yellow marks on the end of your driveway where the foundation's going to go, John?
Dick, I have two backhoes and a truck and a grader in my driveway and out in the street getting ready for tomorrow, but they say it's going to be rain. I have 155 feet of sewer to put in, so I got to dig up my yard under the granite wall. It's a mess.
Yeah, but why you've got all that beautiful hardware there, John, they could be digging the foundation for your concrete pier that goes under that tower. You've got all the right hardware in the right place. You've got a great opportunity there, John. You can turn this this bad news into good news.
I'll have to put them on that subject. I wonder if they'll be talking to me by the end of the day anyway. But I'll find out. I think it's going to start Tuesday because it is. Hopeful anyway. And you have a great week, Dick.
I know you can talk them into it, John. Money talk is bigger than talk. You just peel off some of that outside foliage of that great big roll of money you always have in your pocket, and the problem will go away, John.
I have a big roll now. I just reeled it all up. It's like a big fishing reel with all the money on it. So I just pull it out like a tape machine.
Oh, you've got one of those too. I thought I was the only guy doing that. Bye-bye, you all. John, can you hear me? KC2WGB, K2RIW. Kind of crazy question. The Toyota car my wife owns has one of these crazy keyways, which of the five lugs that hold the wheel onto the hub, one of them has got this crazy key to make sure that that nobody can steal the wheel, okay? The Don Garage put that last lug on with that thing, with an impact wrench, and overdid it. And now when I tried using that keyway to remove that key that left, the Don thing broke off. The keyway failed, and the lug itself also failed. The lug shattered, and the key device both failed. What's your guess as to the right way to get that nasty lug off? Any suggestions? How are you, K2RIW? Yeah, that's right. The broken off nut, which is super tightened by a impact wrench, is there. The top of the nut that has the keyway that goes into the special key tool, it is shattered, and the keyway of the tool is shattered. So therefore, I've got this busted up nut that's super tight onto the lug, holding that wheel on. Over to you. This thing is so badly shattered that I'm going to have to grind it off. There's not enough meat there to drill into it and put in titanium pins like you just described. I kind of thought that was going to be the answer. I've got very little choice but to grind it off. That's going to be a lot of grinding. Over to you, John. Now, not a bad suggestion. I own a nutcracker. That's the good news. This whole lug and its stud, everything is below grade of the rim. This rim has got a lot of depth to it. So I can just barely see the top of that nut. None of it is exposed. It takes a socket wrench to go down in there to get to it, if you know what I mean. I don't think I can get a nutcracker in there, John. Go ahead.
You may ask the gas station attendant or whoever you were going to. They may have a device for removing that. Maybe you have asked them already, but, you know, those guys are pretty crafty.
Okay, that's another suggestion. I'll see what Harbor Freight's got. And other than that, I think I've got to grind it away. And my best guess is I may be able to get a Dremel tool in there. But everything is recessed below this very thick rim, if you know what I mean. Alrighty, thank you. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW.
You want to do that because then you'll be replacing the stud. So, yeah, good luck with that.
Now, replacing the stud is not a big deal. although I'd rather not do that because it really requires a pressing, you know, many thousands of force, pounds of force to do that. So I'm going to try careful grinding. Bye-bye for now.
Put it in and use a spacer and use its nut and just draw it up tight. It'll pull it right into the device, no problem at all. It's getting it out that's the take.
Front-wheel drive car, and the process of doing that much hammering, I think it's a good chance I could do damage to that rotary bearing in that area.
Oh, definitely. You might even do the whatever they call those arms that they have on there and the ball joints or whatever. So, okay, I'll let you go. Good luck. Let me know how you make out.
Roger, Dodger. But you mentioned something good, a ball joint removing tool. There may be a way of crafty way of doing that to remove the old stud if the old stud gets damaged. Okay, bye-bye for now.
KC2W.